Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
There's still on paternity leave, Mark, so it looks like it's just you and me here at the Hoosium on a very wet day. Bucketing down with rain outside, you could almost believe that someone's brought the wet weather with them, couldn't you? And the only people I can see out the window are a few poor souls cowering under that bus shelter.
It's really annoying because I want to go out and make my inessential purchases today.
Hang on, watch this. We don't have a number 192 bus around here, do we?
Eh?
It says 192, Piccadilly, Stockport, Hoosium. There's someone getting off. That's a familiar looking face. Computer, could you open the front doors, please?
Hello, chaps. Quick, get the doors open. It's pouring down out here.
Why, it's none other than Mark's predecessor as resident Diddly-Dum host, Mr. Matt Charlton. Spinster of this parish. The fifth podcaster himself.
Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Delighted to be back. Well, I'd just like to point out it's bright sunshine in Manchester for a change. And I've not set foot on a 192 bus in at least a year and a half. Well, I was just going to say, I hope your shop's open, because that's all I'm here for, really. Now that shops are open here in England, I don't know if they are in the rest of the UK. I want to make my, as was said earlier, inessential purchases, please. Who's Ian Fridge Magnet?
Matt's returning dutifully to the colours in our hour of need to make us up into a trio again. And actually, this means that sanity has finally returned to the world of podcasting, because for the first time since... well, possibly podcast 103 in November 2018 when Hayden was off sick. We have a plurality of Lancastrians in the Hoosium. In fact, if Alan was born in the Wirral, then technically I think that's Cheshire, isn't it? So it's actually could be the first time since podcast 59 in June 2016 that we have a plurality of Lancastrians in the Hoosium. But every silver lining has a cloud, because while the Lancastrians may be in the majority, the clean-shaven are, alas, now in the minority.
Yeah.
It's very strange here, listeners. It's like a Viking invasion. So, in that case, strictly as fifth podcaster... Matt has to slip his way in front of Mark as our sixth podcaster as we introduce ourselves. And so, happy day, faithless sisters, and welcome to episode 147 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Matt.
And I'm Mark.
Yes, for the more recent among our faithless sisters, the order in which we introduce ourselves has... by ancient custom being determined by the date on which we joined the podcast, and then by alphabetical order. So that makes Al No first podcaster, me the second, the Rev the third, and incidentally, we send all our love and best wishes to the Rev, who's been a bit under the weather recently. Nothing serious, we're just nice like that. And then Al No the Rev departed from pastures new, and Hayden fourth podcaster, and Matt fifth, swelled our ranks. The pressures of work robbed us of Matt's company, and in came Mark, sixth podcaster, and Alan, the seventh.
Baker Minor.
Yeah. But as we always say when one of our hosts departs, they're welcome back at any time. And then once they're gone, we quietly change the locks.
Well, I did wonder. I'd still got my key and it didn't work.
Well, I was going to say, depending on how we count podcasts, I mean, just being absent from the actual recording, but sending in a tape to insert during the edit counts as an appearance?
I think that's cheating.
I mean, the unit dating controversy pales by comparison. So this is either, depending on that, this is either Matt's 25th or 26th podcast.
Oh, it's my silver nemesis, then,
and
isn't it?
It leaves Al and the Rev barely ahead on 27 each. So welcome back, Matt. What can we tell you all about Matt if you've not encountered him before? Well, he hates City of Death.
That's still correct.
No, actually, can I just say, I'd just like to say now, I respect Matt for that, because in that same podcast, as I was just a humble but eager listener at the time, and I remember listening to Hayden giving season 17 a jolly good kicking. Season 17 is one of my favourite seasons because of where it stands from when I grew up, and I have a deep emotional attachment to it. And I was listening to Hayden giving it a good kicking, and then I thought, I bet he won't have the balls to include City of Death in his kicking, will he? And no, he didn't. He backed off when it came to City of Death. And full credit to Matt, he didn't care. He went in with both feet and gave it a good sing too. So I respect that, even though I believe you to be wrong. Respect where it's due.
Matt has always had the courage to be mean.
It's 100 minutes of trash. No, it's not 100 minutes of trash.
You and Gary Russell.
I will take that back. It is... I don't get it. I just don't... I don't suppose I really get things like Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I don't get most of Season 17. The most Season 17 thing in it is Destiny of the Daleks. I'll get me coat and go back out in the rain, shall I?
He hates City of Death. Since he left us, we haven't had nearly as much cause to play our Spider-Man music to censor libelous comment. Because he and Hayden have always been our spies, knowing what's going on behind the scenes in Doctor Who and in fandom. It was Matt who famously persuaded Peter Capaldi to record his opening plug for us when he met him at the... Was that the launch of Series 9 at HMV?
Series 9, that would have been, yeah. That was my birthday one year, that was.
Yes,
standing
was,
in a queue with lots of people in a confined space, waiting to meet Peter Capaldi. He was a lovely man, actually. Sorry, what's this for, darling? No, he didn't say darling, but... oh, it's for a podcast I do. Oh, right, what's it about? Can you just say it, please, Peter? Thank you. Fantastic.
There you
are. That lovely, that mate. Right.
And say hello, Diddly Dum.
Yes, please.
Okay. Hello, Diddly Dum. This is Peter Capaldi. I play the Doctor. Diddly Dum, Diddly Dum.
What else happened? He once met Paul McGann on the tube. He once... Did you actually cosplay as Vorschach from Warriors of the Deep for Mark Strickson?
No, that wasn't me.
Or did you not, because you found out he wasn't going to turn up?
No, that wasn't me. Came on to me once. You might have to Spider-Man that bit, actually.
I probably will.
Hello, Dave. How's the business? I'm not called Dave and I don't have a business. Can you get your arms off me, please?
Oh.
I paid £10 for the privilege.
Where's Vorschach coming to my memory from?
I don't know. I quite like Warriors of the Deep. Whether I...
You're planning to cosplay as Vorschach from Warriors of the Deep for Mark Strickson, but he didn't turn up at a convention or something.
God, I can't remember that. I can't remember what happened last week.
Previously on Diddly-Dum.
More importantly, Matt, were you wearing a jumpsuit that made it look as if you were wearing massive wife fronts?
Well, see, Mark Strickson was originally going to be there, and I didn't get the memo that he hadn't gone. And he wasn't. So I dressed up specifically as Vorschach from Warriors of the Deep. I thought that might entertain him.
Nice.
And then when I realised he wasn't going to be there, I took my top off in a homage to Jason Connery, who was also supposed to be there. I then had to be gently told that he wasn't going either, so I looked a bit stupid, unfortunately.
Me and Gareth, my longtime friend and now associate Gareth, who used to run the Lasser Gallery, we were going to cosplay as the Dominators once. That would have been fun.
Fantastic.
We would have shouted at people, "Quarks destroy!" going around conventions. That would have been fun.
Yeah, nobody would have been able to put their arm around you, though.
All the better.
Yeah, well, there we are.
Matt's proudest claim to fame is that his grandmother was at school with Barry Letts.
And subsequently, this makes me sound so arrogant, doesn't it, actually? My mum's done a lot of research on the family tree.
Yeah.
And actually found out that in a weird roundabout and incestuous kind of way, we're actually related to the Letts family.
Oh.
No.
Yeah. So not only was my gran... I must have told the story when she passed away from Alzheimer's, but she used to, when I had Doctor Who on in the latter days of her life, she used to sit up in a chair and go, "I know that name," when we're talking about Barry Letts. But yeah, my mum's found out that the Letts family is sort of our three times, twice removed, fourth cousin, left sideways, parallel universe, this, that, and the other connection to us.
Oh, wow.
So it's a small world. And Peter Cushing's in our family tree somewhere as well.
What? No, that is proper royalty.
I'll have to try and find out what the actual link is. She's got this wonderful piece of software. You just go, bang, any member of the family. It tells you who.
Oh, is it that person? Ancestry.com?
Yeah, she uses Ancestry.
Yeah, I've been on that a few times.
Bit of software that connects to it. But yeah, that's quite interesting, the links to the Leicester area where Barry was from. Nice plug for the Season 8 Blu-ray there, Remembering Barry Letts, the documentary available now.
Season 8 documentary? Which one's that?
That's the one that came out last.
That was the...
Terrorist
documentary, wasn't it? Yeah.
There's a Barry Letts one on it that was on one of the DVDs. I mean, you can tell I've been working my way through that recently,
right.
Can't you?
Yes.
I must watch them all, once with commentary, then the unrestored versions, then the unrestored versions with the production text, and then all the supplementary material that comes with it. My eyes are still bleeding.
But perhaps the most memorable times we had with Matt related to his day job. Because for most of his time with us, Matt was, weren't you, Matt, managing the guided tours of the Coronation Street set at Granada Studios in Manchester.
Dearly gone Coronation Street set. For anyone who remembers the adventures I had there, it's still the best job I'll ever likely to have. It was just such a good experience to do.
Is the sky real?
Yes, the animatronic pigeons are definitely there, yes. Oh, yes, they do realistic poo, don't they? That's right. My favourite one was the... I mean, I could say so much about this now it's shut. The original tour's shut. It has moved across to the newer set, but it's not a move I wanted to make because it's logistically the world. I had a difficult experience at the Emmerdale tours that I went on to do. One reason I had to step away from the podcast because I commuted from Manchester to Leeds on public
that
transport.
That was it, yes.
5 days a week,
God.
Which was perhaps not the best move for me to have made, but it still kept me shoe in. And they film it differently in that they have a purpose-built village about 8 miles outside of Leeds. Everyone in Yorkshire is going to correct me now on how far that is. And they film it in interior studios in Leeds city centre, whereas Coronation Street, you walked out the studios onto the street itself, which, if you're not necessarily as aware of how these things are made, if you're coming to an attraction that has indoor sets, expecting to see the outdoor, or vice versa, most people got the explanation, but for those who truly inhabit that world when they're watching the soaps, and no disrespect's intended by those people, it was very confusing for them. And unfortunately, I then moved away from the soap sphere to go and do the Crystal Maze live experience after that. So I've been working my way around every TV show you can imagine.
Those people who get confused about the Coronation Street sets, they're the same people who write in to let Gail know that Richard is a wrong un and things like that.
Exactly. And that's their escapism. You know, I'm not going to knock it because I saw the joy it brought to people. But at the same time, that lack of sort of thinking, you would just assume that when they go inside a house and it cuts to the interior, perhaps, that I think the same is true for some Doctor Who fans, that there's a police box entrance on the actual set you can walk through into the TARDIS itself. You know, and that, I think, is the sort of converse that blows people's
minds. Like Longley.
Yeah. And actually, I suppose I'm also doing... I've moved channels now as well, because I'm not going to say a word about the Crystal Maze experience. Let's just put it was an experience. And not in a good way for me. It kind of... what I will say is it kind of has made me reevaluate where I want to be, because it was not the nicest time for me there. But I've also now got a job tour guiding at BBC Salford, as we call it. Not Manchester, BBC Salford.
All right.
Which is actual sets, actual things, proper things, some example things that you can show. And sadly, I only got to do, I could literally count the tours I did in one hand before COVID hit.
Right.
So quite when and how we'll return to all of that, I just don't know. I understand all the restrictions, you know, and I don't see how you can necessarily take people to see working sets and environments now in this scenario. But what was interesting is you had the converse there. You had people who were desperate to know how TV works. Well, you do have people because it will still go on. You have people who are desperate to know how TV works and sit where the presenters are and see the cameras and see everything like that and really absorb themselves in it. But most interesting for me was the kids' tours, which I'm not very good at because I'm not really a kiddie person. You know, I'm the crazy uncle in the attic. But our tour starts by a replica of the TARDIS, which has been done up to represent Jodie Whittaker's TARDIS now. It's not a Doctor Who thing, it's just a useful meeting point because you'd hope that if somebody got lost or didn't know where they were going, the majority of people would know you meet at the TARDIS, you know, and that you'd know what that is. And in our exhibition room, we have two Daleks, which I gather were used in Asylum of the Daleks and a few other stories as well, when they all got shipped off down to Cardiff for those Dalek Parliament scenes. And the kids just don't know what they are. They don't recognise them.
I've heard this.
And I don't want to get into knocking. Personally, I think the series, I was quite critical of Stephen Moffat's era. I've actually gone back, rewatched them, enjoyed a lot of them. I think the Jodie Whittaker era, I don't think the show has looked better at all in terms of its cinematography and effects. I think the storylines are fine. I don't have a problem with the Timeless Children. I think that validates every kid who's ever run around a school playground pretending to be Doctor Who. Possibly, it's just come a little bit late in the day. Now that the kids aren't watching on a Sunday, they don't know what it is. You know, I made the couple of gags about the TARDIS and the Daleks, and it was when the first couple of times they fell flat, I just thought to myself, ooh, that's a problem for the show.
Were you dressed up as Vorash at this point?
Well, this is the problem. I was walking around dressed as Vorshak.
Oh, sorry, Vorshak.
With my other guide behind me dressed as a sea devil, and they probably wondered what was going on. But I do find it alarming. They know what Strictly is. They know what Blue Peter is. You know, no disrespect to Blue Peter, less than a million people watching that.
Yeah.
But they don't know what the TARDIS is. They were more excited, and again, I've been in that sphere, so I'm not knocking it, but they were more excited about the little Albert Square mock-up and the countdown clock. They recognise those, but they don't recognise an icon that's been on TV for over 50 years. That's worrying.
Mm. That surely is disturbing, isn't it? Because when in 2005, it was, I don't think kids just started watching Doctor Who. I think it was the parents making them watch it. And if those kids don't grow up to be parents with memories of Doctor Who, lordy.
Yeah, because there's this whole perception nobody's watching the programme. And I think it's proven by the ratings. The way we watch and consume television is completely different. So for everyone that's sat there refreshing the screens and going, only 4 million watch Rosa, so the programme's going down the pan, then that's not representative of what's going on. If you'd put Doctor Who on during COVID, the viewing figures would have shot up because no one was allowed to go anywhere. The same is true of any programme, I think. But I think you probably hit the nail on the head there. If the mums and dads aren't sitting down the children to watch it, then the viewing figures are drifting away because there'll always be a hardcore. You could put a turd in a microwave for 50 minutes. As long as it had the titles at the start and the music at the end, we'd all still watch it. And we'd all still buy it on DVD/Blu-ray. And we'd all still buy our Andrew Pixley making of, which would be very short for a turd in a microwave. But your, dare I say it, casual viewer has drifted off. Which I think is a shame. Yeah. That's a downbeat note, isn't it? Hi! I bet you're glad I'm back, folks.
Because Mark regularly watches Doctor Who, when he can escape a lockdown, watches Doctor Who with the very young children of some of his friends. And they're hypnotised by it, aren't they, Mike? No, mesmerised, rather.
Yes, yeah, the early new series stuff has gone down very well. I haven't tried the classic series yet with the younger girls. The Kellys. And one of my friend's children said he would love to watch a multi-doctor story. And so I said, there's probably none better, really, than the Five Doctors. And he said, oh, which doctors are in that? And I said, oh, it's got Peter Davison. And their face just glazed over. And they were like, oh that, no, that's a really old one, isn't it? They weren't interested.
It hits an interesting period, doesn't it, the programme? The new series is now over 15 years old. that's now classic. I mean, there'll be kids watching it when they're born. How old are these kids that are watching it, Mark?
They are 7 and 9.
Oh, they're the perfect age.
Yeah. On broadcast, they loved Capaldi's last season. They loved the first season of Jodie Whittaker. And then there was that huge gap, and they just fell away from it during that huge gap. I mean, they enjoyed watching, catching up with some of the older stuff, some of the, like the Christopher Ecclestons and the early David Tennants, which we did in between. But that huge gap between series, the kids just disappeared during it. And I think that's probably happened on a much larger scale than just that household.
Yeah, because nowadays, an 18-month gap, we all survived 16 years without the programme, barring a brief blip in 96. But if you're a kid, that's an eternity, isn't it? Yeah. 18 months. You know, whole waves of fads come and go during that period, especially when there's no kids' magazine to drive it. I'm sounding very kid-centric here, but I believe it's the future of the programme.
Yeah, well, I believe they are the future.
But clearly, if they're not watching it on Sunday, that means their parents aren't making them, in inverted commas, watch it. So, I don't know.
Sunday is a difficult night because you're getting ready for work on the Monday. You're getting ready for school on the Monday.
Yeah.
Mm.
The only one I think I've watched out the 2 years that Jodie Whittaker's been on a Sunday was by a complete fluke, Fugitive of the Jadoon, which was the first episode I'd watched of that series.
Yes.
I hadn't got round to watching the because I'm still working in a visitor attraction. Yeah. You don't get home in time. You know, I'm not the only one that's working on a Sunday either. What an episode to tune in for. Yeah. I just about fell off my chair.
Do you think, I wonder if they're all like that before this? I've got to check it out.
Well, I did. And then I went back and watched Spyfall immediately on iPlayer because I was just so stoked up. So I just thought, something just made me, just all coalesced. I had no idea that Captain Jack was coming back. And I do like this new secretive nature the programme's got. You know, if they'd have dropped in another Doctor during David Tennant's era that no one knew was coming, Gallifrey base would have melted. I mean, probably melted anyway. But the flip side of that is, and I suppose this is something the Timeless Children or Timeless Child or whatever it's called has done, is we've now... There's forever going to be that pub quiz question, isn't there, about the first Black Doctor.
Yeah.
And now, because we're not going to see that adventure, and I wonder how... I'm going very, very deep here, but I wonder how that's going to be represented when it comes to... We're going to inevitably have a Black female, a Black male, an Indian female, an Indian male. We have an Indian master, I suppose.
Yeah.
I might be getting Sasha's background wrong there as well, but I think it's fantastic casting. I think Joe Martin was just brilliant, but I do. You robbed that cultural milestone. I think it was a great idea, but at the same time, the papers are going to make a big splash when we do have a Black James Bond or a person of colour doing James Bond and a person of colour doing Doctor Who. But you're going to have this subset of Doctor Who fans going, actually, I think you'll find in the 2000 whatever year it was transmitted episode Fugitive of the Jadoon. But I applaud Chris Chibnall for rewriting the mythos on it. I saw Christopher Eccleston's comments about Doctor Who's got to change its canon. To hear that word coming out of his mouth is quite interesting. Respect to the big finishes.
We were talking about this on our last podcast with Dave Kitchen. And I can usually do without listening to Chris Eccleston when he's doing anything but acting. Because I think, I don't know if you've read the latest EWM, Matt. But at the point where he says, I didn't go to Oxbridge, I don't do irony. I thought, Christ. But no, you're saying, oh, well done to Chris Chibnall, right? So, Matt, if you just move, just stand over that.
That square in the floor.
Have you got the lever, Matt?
Oh, Mark? Is this a trap door, is it? Now, I will die on the Cribnall, I will die on the Chibnall cross, because he's not the perfect showrunner, but I think for everyone who thought we were going to get Toby Whithouse or I can't remember any of the names that were Neil Cross or any of the other names, he has advanced it in a way you're going to get flamed if I say it. So
I don't care.
I think if David Tennant's season 4 finale had been The Timeless Children, I think everyone would have embraced it, loved it and said, what a hero Russell T. Davis is. But I think it's become fashionable to knock I mean, somebody, Chibnall's made a rod for his own back in going on open air in 1986 and castigating poor Pip and Jane Baker. That will forever haunt him, unfortunately. But he's advancing the mythos in a way. I mean, I just love that timeless children element, that there are now infinite variations of the Doctor.
See, I hate that.
Yeah, me too.
Genuinely, for me, that takes away from the character. It doesn't add to it. I know the arguments for and against, but I'm definitely in the against camp, I'm afraid.
What he means is he's in the camp that's against it. He's not against camp. We're podcasters. We can't be against camp.
That's a whole nother conversation.
Well, I like season 17, so that's hardly... Yeah. I'm hardly going to be against it, am I?
My view of the thousands and thousands of past Doctors now is not so much that it makes it amazing, but I think it makes it almost... This is only my own opinion. Makes it almost banal.
Bland. Banal.
You know, just another... I mean, we've never been a podcast that cared what each other thought about something. But I just didn't like it at all. But we'll see how things go. We'll see how things go. It's possible, yeah, maybe if it'd been David Tennant. Maybe not David Tennant, because I wasn't particularly keen on him either. So maybe someone else. It might have been different. But I've never really been engaged by the current TARDIS crew, other than Bradley. They just don't do much for me. Anyway.
I am glad that Yaz has stuck around. I think she's terrific. I think she...
I hope she gets a chance, yeah.
What's her name? Mandip Gill. I think she also knows the responsibility she has in doing it to not just the young girls and boys that are watching, but the young girls and boys of people of colour who are watching, that someone can be successful and travel in space and time. Not literally, of course, but I mean, that would be an achievement, that would be. But yeah.
Well, I tell you what, talking of Bradley Walsh, you know how everyone was saying when he was signed, oh, what's he like when he's seen on game shows? Usually people would say, oh, apparently he's on Law and Order UK, and I've heard he's not bad on it. I actually watched an episode of that last night, and he's really, really good in it. He's not, like Peter Capaldi, you know, sort of, wow, what an amazing actor. But he's just very, very understated and underplayed as a London policeman. He's really good.
Well, he was also in Coronation Street as Mike Baldwin's son.
Mike Baldwin's son?
Yeah, no, he was Mike Baldwin's son or cousin, or I can't remember now, but they brought him and Deborah Stevenson in. And obviously his career, and her career, arguably, just kind of took off and went in a different direction. But I think it's a shame because, no, he wasn't excellent in that, but if he'd have stayed, he'd be running the street in the same way that you had Peggy Mitchell running the square. You know, obviously it's not necessarily what he wanted to do. I mean, he's such an insanely busy man. I'm surprised we had him for two seasons of Doctor Who.
Mind you, you had, what's his name, for a few years, didn't you? What's his name? Gandalf?
Oh, Ian McKellen.
The countless cobbles these people have walked, or some line like that.
So we'll definitely have to have Matt on more often, because we finally found one of our hosts who likes the Jodie era. Where were we? Oh, Guided Tours of the Coronation Street, that was right. And, in fact, Matt's hangover, when he podcasted with us the day after his team had won the Greater Manchester Tourism Award for 2015.
Oh, I didn't, did I? Oh, God.
Remains stuff of diddly-dum legend.
Oh, do you know, I'm not a big drinker, but that was a tremendous night. I mean, sorry, Spider-Man that bit. Some unnamed organisation ploughed so much money into the drink for us. Oh, my God. And I projectile vomited in the alleyway behind Gail Platt's garden as well that day.
Oh, we didn't hear that.
Yeah, no, because I nearly got sent home because I clearly looked unwell. I mean, there are some more hardy drinkers there than I was, and I had to run out. Our office was above the newsagents, the cabin, and there was a gangway out the back, and I projectile vomited off it all into the alleyway that ran behind Gail Platt's back garden. That'll go in the autobiography.
So the next day when you were taking people around, they said, is that sick real? You said, no, it's just very, very convincing. And many was the evening when we were recording a podcast with us sitting in comfort here in the Diddly Dum studio while our state-of-the-art equipment connected us to Matt's phone as he walked around the Coronation Street set at night, locking up.
Do you know, I was quite grateful for the...
And caught buses home.
Well, I was quite grateful for the company, because that was a spooky place. I had an encounter there with a ghost.
Of course! Was that the one in the Rovers?
Yeah. The horse and cart, yeah.
Horse and cart?
I heard a horse and cart.
Oh, sorry, I thought that was the name of the... I thought they'd renamed the Rovers. The horse and cart.
Do you want a pint in the horse and cart, love?
Many is the Doctor Who review we've heard from inside the toilets of the Rover's Return, as Matt was checking that all the cubicles were empty before locking the doors. Matt locking up the Rover's Return, that almost makes me think of him as Bette Lynch, leaving the keys on the bar before quitting.
Oh, that's a great scene, that is. That's a great scene.
Hang on, what's that?
Can you hear contact? There's a wormhole opening up, reaching the museum.
Is that a roaring wind I can hear?
a freak wormhole has opened up in the fabric of the space-time continuum, and we are now, even as we speak, driving a Skype connection through it from the museum. Northwards. Ever northwards. To the County Palatine. Matt, are you there?
I've just punched my way through 2 billion years of diamond to get here. Gents, hi, faithless listeners. Gents, that's my thoughts on Heaven Sent. I've been brilliant.
Thanks for your contribution, Matt.
As always happens, Matt, when you eventually join us to put through going to podcast, you came the long way round.
Matt, where are you?
I'm in Weatherfield. I dumped me. Weatherfield Medical Center.
We're just opening the map in the studio.
It's not bloody treasure hunt, not on price.
Now, Weatherfield. Oh! I see it! Put the helicopter on the map.
Oh, I've got the clue. Stop the clock.
Would you like to introduce your camera and sound crew to us, Matt?
Yeah, my cameraman is Doc behind me, and we've got Hayden on the mic. Sorry, just hold that thought, because I'm just going to exit work. I've just got to do a handover to security, and then I'll be back. Just 2 secs. Ah, and one more light switch.
Oh dear, it's windy in Weatherfield.
Finally. Cheers. Ta-da now.
Right. I'm going to save that, and when I say at the beginning, Matt, what did you think of Sleep No More? I'm going to insert your security guard saying, bit of a bummer, innit?
I had a very busy weekend. Sorry, I'll wait until that noise dies down before I go on.
What noise?
That, Matt?
Are you on the bus, Matt?
I'm on the bus.
Oh, right, yeah. Okay.
Which bus are you on?
I'm on the 192.
The famous 192. Isn't that the ghost bus?
No, it's mostly known as the death bus.
Is that a purple triple decker?
It's more like Aris Wild Times. I might keep fading in and out slightly for this bit because it's a particularly dodgy stretch of the A6.
But if you thought podcasting via a phone from a TV set was impressive, it was nothing compared to the many podcasts recorded from the top deck of the 192 bus as Matt returned home. Usually to be greeted by Gareth Cavanagh's late budgie, I seem to recall.
Yes. Yeah, they're both gone now.
You're keeping it for him?
Yeah, I used to look after it when he went away. Because I'm a bit of a bird man myself in some respects, so...
When you say they're both gone, you don't mean Gareth and his budgie?
No, just the budgies.
Oh,
well,
they're
the cockatoos. The cockatoos, Ernie and Sydney. That, yeah, sadly, they both passed on. I mean, they both got to a good age and they both had, you know, a marvellous life as well. Even if one of them did tear off all the keys off Gareth's keyboard at one point.
Oh.
His computer keyboard. He went out to do something, either collect a parcel or something. And I remember the picture being sent through with howling laughter of his destroyed keyboard and his laptop. And the cockatoo sat on it, just looking defiantly at the camera.
I've heard that was clicking their beaks in the background. And many's the time on the podcast, I'd say something. I'd hear that beak click and I'd say, who's tutting? What's wrong with that?
Unfortunately, I can't shut it up.
I'm afraid we've had some rather sad news. As it has been announced from Cavanagh Towers that Sydney the Cockatiel has died. Now, those of you who were around during the Matt Charlton era of the Diddly Dum podcast will recall that Matt always seemed to synchronise recording a Diddly Dum podcast episode with babysitting Gareth Cockatiel for him. And so you will have heard, on regular occasions, have heard Sydney chirping in the background of our podcast during those days. Happy times. So our heartfelt sympathies go out to Gareth. So Matt, work life aside, as far as Doctor Who fandom's concerned and the actual current series aside, anything been going on in your life since last we spoke? Or rather, since last we bumped elbows?
Yeah, I went to the BFI for the Talons of Wayne Chang one, and that was deserted, which I think you were supposed to be there, weren't you?
Yes, we were. It was my birthday weekend, wasn't it, I think? Oh, there was supposed to be, the day after was supposed to be the Terence Dix...
Oh, it was,
gathering.
Wasn't it?
Yes.
That's right.
And so we were going... it was going to be like a bumper weekend, sort of mountain of Doctor Who stuff for me. And then COVID hit. And yeah, we didn't bother with the Tanzi Wang Chang in the end. It didn't seem worth the risk at the time. Oh, I saw somebody on Twitter. Now, the Talons thing was supposed to have a dedicated panel talking about racism in Doctor Who.
And, yes, it was, wasn't it? Yeah.
At the time. And then I saw somebody on Twitter who was absolutely taking the BFI to task for completely ignoring the racism in Talons of Wang Chang and criticising them for choosing that story to show without addressing the racism. And they put a huge long thread on Twitter, and I put under their first thing, this whole thread started on the wrong thing because they tried to have a panel discussing the racism about it. That was one of the reasons, I think, why they picked it as well. And I said the only reason that panel didn't go ahead was because of the pandemic, so that they had to cut the amount of people.
That's exactly it. The organisers, they said when we were there, because that was one of the bits we were looking forward to hearing the open discussion about it, especially as there have been so many conversations with groups like the Time Team in Doctor Who magazine. Many of those have taken issue with the representation of the characters in Talons.
Mm.
But nobody was there, unfortunately. And they had a statement, I'm sure they had a statement that was read out that was to the effect of, well, I don't want to paraphrase it because I don't want it to be, but it was kind of like, well, we're not there, unfortunately, and this is a discussion that will have to carry on in the future. And of course it hasn't. I mean, thankfully, I suppose, in terms of keeping it all intact, that season is now out and it's there for everyone to enjoy. Well, enjoy or throw wet sponges at. But yeah, it was a shame because I remember I walked from Euston that day to the BFI, as invariably I do. I always get an early train and take in a bit of London. And I got to Trafalgar Square in my roundabout route of going to the BFI, and it was deserted at 10 o'clock in the morning. And I thought to myself, ooh, this probably was a mistake.
Yeah.
And I got to the BFI, and it was half empty.
But for lockdown reasons, wasn't it? It wasn't because it wasn't popular.
Oh, yeah, no, it was all for... They could easily have social distanced us, even though we didn't really know what social distancing was at the time.
Yes, it's strange, isn't it? I mean, yeah. Hayden and I went to the BFI screening for Power of the Daleks. That's when we bumped into Matt. And then the three of us went along to, didn't we, Mark, to Planet of the Daleks. We had Katie just sitting across the aisle from us, didn't we? That was a good one. So let's hope things get better. And of course,
I hope those events return, yeah.
What we've been doing since, in your absence, Matt, is that we've become conventioneers, haven't we, Mark?
Ah, oh, brilliant!
Yeah. All my rants about, I can't think of anything more lacking in self-respect than standing in a queue to get someone's autograph. And then Hayden dragged us along to the Dwast Capital Convention down in South London once, and we've not looked back, have we?
No.
In fact, the Diddly Dum podcast is technically the official podcast
official podcast of the Capital, isn't it? Yeah, I did see that, yeah. Yeah, I desperately wanted to get to the Capitol because they got a good range of guests as well. I will shamelessly queue up to get some autographs.
It's really good.
Yeah, it was. I mean, we were blessed, really, weren't we? I think that because we missed the first one. We went to the second one, And I think it was the arrival of Katie Manning, which absolutely sealed the deal, wasn't it? When she walked into the corridor. Well, even before she made it into the corridor, and you could hear her about sort of like 10 yards away or something.
Oh, that lady knows how to make an entrance.
Well, we couldn't work out, could we, why Katie's autograph queues were moving so slowly until we got to the front and saw that every person that came in, she was standing up, coming around the table, hugging them. Going back around the table for a chat and signing things, then coming back around the table to hug them before they left as well.
She is such a trooper. She's such a trooper. For something else that I'll come on to have a discussion about in a moment, I've been in contact and emailing her, and the emails I have back from her are just so lovely. Even though we haven't been able to arrange what we wanted to do, she just wants to make everybody happy.
Is that sort of been linked, sort of in association with the Fab Cafe thing, sort of things you used to do in Manchester?
No, this is in association with mine and Gareth's lockdown project. Well, it's not a lockdown project, it'll carry on post-lockdown. I don't want to start that rumour. The Cutaway Comics that we're doing.
Oh, cool. Tell us more. Was it love at first sight?
Our eyes locked across a crowded convention hall. No, well, obviously, myself and Gareth and others, it's not just me and Gareth, I should point out, but we're both... I suppose one reason we both knuckled down is we both kind of got a consultancy project management kind of background. So we can sit down and look at a spreadsheet and go, right, these are the pieces that need to happen to make something. Who can we get to help us? So it's kind of the two of us that have done a lot of events in theatre with such a wide team of people across Manchester and beyond across the last few years. And he's obviously, him and Colin Brockhurst published Warp Warp, the fanzine about DWM again, amongst a
glorious
range
magazine
of contributors. So there's a background in publishing, and he's always wanted to do stories set in the backup universe, effectively. The project was originally called Doctorless Universe, and at a convention, Gareth was there. This is going to sound like such name dropping now, but he was there to see Philip Hinchcliffe, because we did a production of his Screen One film, and Bill Humble wrote it, called Virtuoso, about the pianist John Ogden in Manchester and his struggles with mental health that ultimately destroyed him, unfortunately. And Philip was so up for us doing that as a piece of theatre in Manchester, which was a cracking piece. But then across the other side of the convention hall, Gareth saw Eric Saywood and just went up to Eric and said, if we were to do a comic book based on one of your characters, i.e. something like Lytton, would you be interested in writing it? And Eric kind of was, Eric admits this himself, he was kind of a bit rabbit in the headlights going, sorry, what? Hang on. Gareth slipped him a business card, and then a little bit further down the line, gets a phone call from Eric going, tell me more about this comic book idea. And it's kind of spiralled from there, because we announced this project years ago, and had it not been for COVID, I don't think we'd have necessarily sat down and progressed it as much as we have.
Yeah.
Because from there, we've got four-part series based on Lytton and his adventures in 1970s Soho. So he swapped his intergalactic lifestyle for a jazz club in Soho, which would be all lovely and fine and dandy if it wasn't for the strange noises coming from the sewer and the aliens stalking the back streets of London. So we're already in quite Eric Saywood territory here. And it's Eric's first comic, you know, and he's found he's really enjoyed writing for the character. Well, yes, he has really enjoyed writing for the character, because he's doing Orsini on the back of that. And he's got ideas for lots more stuff as well. Lots and lots more stuff. So, you know, that's fantastic. And we did it through Kickstarter initially, because it was the best way.
Yes.
No one was selling comics. If we'd have gone to comic shops and tried to sell it that way, I think it wouldn't have got much further, because that shop window has been opening and closing and opening and closing. I mean, I think the last we heard, issue one of Lytton is still on the shelves of Forbidden Planet in London, and we're coming up to issue four. So, and that's nobody's fault, but that's just the way it's turned out.
That's because people aren't on the streets.
Yeah, you'd never be able to keep up with it. I feel for those comic collectors that perhaps haven't been able to do what they normally do over the course of the last year. But then the Kickstarter was very successful, much more successful than we were expecting. So we started to play with the stretch goals, and that's where Orsini as a one-shot, furthering William Gaunt's adventure, and Bostock from Revelation of the Daleks came from. Then we did a deal to do a comic of Omega, which is set on Minyos, as we saw in Underworld. Now, obviously, you see the link there is Bob Baker. But now Bob's writing an Eldrad comic for us as a one-shot, which again came about through the Kickstarter. So we're playing with exciting goals and exciting projects because these might not ever come around again.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got, on Omega, you've got John Ridgway, haven't you, as the artist?
Yeah, I can't not mention John because we brought him back to the Doctor Who fold. And
yeah,
that man is a metronome. Like clockwork, every 3 days, two new pages would come through. I mean, there's no risk of this not being completed. All four issues have been drawn. In fact, John might do more bits and pieces for us. I mean, for some of our very, very lucky backers, they're going to be in the comic. And John had already drawn it by that point, but he's, no problem, I'll go back and redo that.
Oh.
He's such a wonder to work. And he's, you know, he's in his 80s now. And he's like a metronome. I mean, all of the artists, we've got Barry Renshaw doing Lytton, and we've got, we did a call out for Paradise Towers, which is the next title we're launching, which is a sequel to Paradise Towers, set some years after the TV show, which will expand that world even more, because it's called Paradise Towers, not Paradise Tower. We only saw one.
Mm.
So there's all this to explore. Stephen Wyatt signed off the script. I mean, Stephen's extremely involved in all of this, even though he's not writing the comic. And we've got an extraordinary Italian artist called Silvano Beltramo, who's doing the artwork, who again is just, he's so fast, but he's so clear in what he wants. Because he's sent page roughs to us. And my involvement in this, well, I'll come on to my involvement in it, but I'm including all of it. He sent page roughs to us that are just so precise that, you know, he wants to make sure it's what Stephen wants, what our writer Sean Mason wants. And he's just amazing. And I'm doing some VAM discs. Obviously, VAM is a term that we'll all know from the Doctor Who DVDs, but we want to go beyond the comics. So if you buy the comics on the Kickstarter that include the discs or directly from the Cutaway Comics website, you might want to add a little ting there on my teeth at that point. But we'll give you a VAM disc that's got, and we're doing our best here because obviously we're coming out of lockdown. We've recorded some stuff, but we'll keep going with them. A brand new commentary for a Doctor Who story. So we've had David Banks on Earthshock for the first time.
Ooh.
And Attack of the Cybermen as well. David's been a revelation. He's just so easy and so fantastic to work with.
Yeah, I met him at a convention and he was lovely to chat to. Really easy going guy.
David who?
Banks.
David, oh, right, Banks. Yes.
Excellent.
Wasn't he the guy who signed your Terrence Sticks monster book?
Oh, my Doctor Who monster book, because it's got a bit where it says Revenge of the Cybermen, and it's got the photograph is of Cybermen getting out of the tomb in the Tomb of the Cybermen, isn't it? And so I got him to write, "This is not canon," and sign it.
Oh, we ought to get him and Eccleston together then.
Oh, he strikes me as a chap who might have loved that. I mean, we've got a challenge here because we can't get people in the same room to record these.
Yes, of course, yeah.
And poor David was in south of France with his internet not working, trying to join us for a commentary over Zoom. So that gives away how we do it, but you'll look at that.
Yes, it is awkward, isn't it? I mean, because you've had to come all the way down to Mummerset, haven't you, to record this? So it's impossible if you're not in the same room. But I was thinking, when you were thinking John Ridgway, I was thinking, didn't we interview him?
Mark? No, no, that was John Freeman, the editor, one-time editor of DWM, who also writes a lot of comic strips.
Mm. That John's been quite supportive of this project as well, because obviously this is amalgamated from so much sort of publishing experience. And we got lots of treats in for the discs. They include video features, historical panels that we've recorded from Doctor Who. We want to make it sort of a Criterion collection for Doctor Who fans, because we're conscious that some people are quite happily buy the comic and bin it for the disc, and there are other people who will buy the comic and bin the disc, and there are people who love both, and that's absolutely fine. But let me give you chaps a little something as I'm here. My entry cost to the Whozian this time, because we've announced, obviously, Lytton, Omega and Paradise Towers, and we've got 1, 2, 3 more titles, at least, in the pipeline that we're talking about. We're not going to announce anything until we've signed and sealed on the various deals that we need to do, because if we do, obviously it might potentially upset various rights holders, other bits and pieces. But we have signed one deal that we can announce, and we're delighted to say that sometime, probably early next year now, we're going to be doing a 4-part series on the Happiness Patrol.
Oh, brilliant.
Which we've got a writer in mind and we've got an artist in mind. And as soon as we've done the deal on those, we'll let everyone know. But it's a little bit going to be my baby, this one, because I'm driving forward the vision for it. And I think we're going to do a wonderful job. Obviously, poor Graham Curry is no longer with us. So we're looking at a writer that we've got in mind that is going to bring that vision to life, that's going to enhance and build on that world. And we hope everyone will enjoy it. Build high for happiness in another way.
Will it be a prequel? Are you allowed to say yet, or were you keeping that under wraps?
I'm keeping that little bit under wraps for the moment.
Okay.
Ooh, he's naughty.
We're looking at one side project that will jump around in the timeline.
Ah, okay.
Well, the first time I heard of Cutaway, I spoke to Gareth, because we had Gareth on, actually in Matt's era, Podcast 32, in, I think it was April, April 2015, he said, with the spreadsheet in front of him. Oh, so introducing Gareth, warp, warp, da-da-da. Lala and K9's nationwide interview. How Matt and Gareth met. Gary Russell burned in effigy. An afternoon with Terence Dix. That was you, wasn't it, Matt? Or was that Gareth?
No, I think that was Gareth did that one. I was there for it, though.
Anyway, so I dropped Gareth a message and said, oh, do you fancy coming on the podcast sometime to talk about Cutaway Comics? I said, oh, yeah, sure. And so, we'll have to see if we can get the two of you on. Because when you were saying, because I'm involved in Cutaway as well, and I expressed astonishment, and I just remembered, we spent a long time during one podcast talking about the, you wrote a whole thing in DWM for about it, didn't you?
Oh, yes, I did.
We were saying, bloody Matt, welcome on the bloody podcast again. What, he'll appear in DWM, or we're not having him again.
Well, you see, the thing is, I'm the sacrificial lamb in all of this, because Gareth's running his arcade machine business. So he's off tinkering with those in various locations. Yeah, no, he services and looks after arcade machines that go into various pubs and clubs and bars up and down the country, which of course comes with it a lot of travelling as well. So I think I'm the sacrificial lamb, because I remember when he rang me about that article saying, oh yes, you'd love to do that, wouldn't you? Yes, Gareth, absolutely. When's the deadline? Oh, it's in 10 days' time. No problem. I mean, that was lovely to have their support on that as well.
Returning to the Who's Ian, Matt, we think of you more as the prodigal son than the sacrificial lamb.
Thank God for that.
Oh, but if they ever do restart Capitol again, you have to see if you can come down.
Well, I'm going to make most of the convention scene when it returns, to be fair. I mean, I sound like I'm going to be dancing on tables and stuff, but I've missed them a lot more than I thought I would.
It is devilishly easy to miss your meal times at these conventions, though, isn't it?
To be fair. Yeah.
And that, it's a mark of how fun they are. You know, suddenly you think, oh, God, it's 10 o'clock at night.
Yeah, exactly.
That's one of the best things for me is that... Spider-Man does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches
seeds
just like flies. Look out, here comes
a
Spider-Man.
You can't put that in.
Don't worry, I'm not going to be broadcasting that.
Go on, tell us who one of them is. Go on.
Well, is he strong? Listen, bud.
He's got radioactive blood. Says all you need to know, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'll send you the unedited interviews, Matt, if you promise to treat them with the same confidentiality as we treated your story about... Can you swing from a thread? Take a
look overhead. Hey there! That's amazing. That is the greatest convention story I've ever heard.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Ding! Oh, my God!
I had no idea you knew Alan, by the way. Alan Lear.
Yeah, I know Alan.
Because he was on for a couple of years with us, wasn't he?
My spiritual successor. I like Alan.
Yeah, I'm still in touch with Alan.
Him and Eric could do some good bashes, actually, up in Liverpool.
Yes, Mark went to...
Yes, I went to one.
One, didn't you, Mark? And met...
Oh, did you go to the... did you go to that one as well?
The Who at Hoylake that David Banks and... Oh, who else was there?
Oh, no, I don't know. This was Sophie Aldred, Richard Franklin.
Yeah, Richard Franklin was there.
Katie Manning.
Hayden and I were trying to get Mark to get a glossy print-off of that still photo of Richard Franklin's death in Emmerdale, where he's got his hand over the... just dying over the back of the cow, and get him to sign it, but we didn't dare, did we, there, Mark?
No. We did, in fact, I believe it's Matt. Is it Matt who coined the term the war bungle?
Yes.
The war bungle.
Oh, tell Matt about what you did to Sci-Fi by the Sea.
Well, do you know what we're talking about, Matt? There was one of your podcasts and you were discussing the first ever Bungle as played by John Leeson.
Yes.
And it's quite a gruesome looking Bungle, isn't it? It's not it's quite scary. As friendly.
It's really scary.
No, I thought it was you, Matt, who said, yeah, it's the Bungle nobody talks about.
Is it true that John Leeson used to be Bungle?
Yeah.
Actually, inside or...?
Yep, he was the original Bungle. If you Google a picture of it or go on YouTube and look at some of the really early Rainbow episodes, we nickname him the War Bungle.
Hey!
Brilliant! It's the one we just don't talk about. It's horrific.
And so I got a photograph of this Bungle and I went out to John Leeson signing in Herne Bay in Kent and said to him, I don't suppose, cause not only did I get him to do an introduction to the podcast for us in the voice of K9, which he did superbly and was incredibly gracious and nice about. I also got him to sign a photograph to Diddley Dum from the War Bungle.
What was funny was, according to Mark, he absolutely understood our little sort of riff about the War Bungle, but he had to have explained to you what a podcast was.
I love John. I'll tell you a Spider-Man story about John. We had him up in... I tried to show him a clip of the War Bungle, actually, that failed spectacularly when the video screen froze behind me at a convention in Manchester. But at said convention, you... But he's a legend, John Lee.
It's brilliant, yeah. Mm. Anyway, we asked Matt to suggest a story we could look at while he was visiting us. And so, Matt has chosen for us the third Doctor story, Colony in Space.
Why?
Or, as it was known to boomers like Mark and myself before UK Gold and Home Video came across, The Doomsday Weapon. Or The Purple Book, written by Malcolm Hulk, directed by Michael Bryant, in the era when Terrence Dicks was script editor and Barry Letts was producer. Transmitted April and May 1971. Ratings around about... Lowest episode was 7.6 million viewers. Highest was 9.5. Matt, tell us why you like Colony in Space.
Well, I thought I was going to talk about the demons, actually, but... No, Colony in Space. I mean, there's obviously a recurring theme here, isn't there? I'd rather watch 6 episodes of Colony in Space than 4 episodes of City of Death any day. No, Colony in Space, I think I've always liked it from when I first saw it, and I've never read The Target, I should point out to this bit, because I think it's a wonderfully cynical view. In the Pertwee era, where we have the UNIT family and cuddly Uncle John on Earth, and Joe Grant, who is one of the best, you know, one of the best companions, really, you know, in terms of... Well, she is one of the best companions. Yeah. And you bookended by Sarah Jane Smith. And Liz Shaw is good, but unfortunately Caroline John never got the chance to expand on her role in that series. But this is such a cynical view of the future where everyone is a commodity on Earth. And you've got this ragtag bunch of... They're not space hippies. They're just normal people trying to get on with a normal life away from all the histrionics on Earth. And in comes the Interplanetary Mining Corporation. Why no one's ever returned to that as a recurring theme, I don't know. And it is a Western in space. But on top of that, you've got where it sits in the series. It's the first trip onto another planet for a year and a half. You know, if you did that now in the current series, could you imagine it? A year and a half without going to another alien planet? Yeah, okay, it's China Pit. But right from the very word start, you've got Joe Grant, who's been with this programme for nearly a year and has never seen the inside of the TARDIS.
Yeah.
And then John Pertwee turns his entire characterisation on its head in possibly one of the most frightening moments since the first episode, where he just brushes her off. He's too excited about the prospect of going out to another planet that she's having a bit of a breakdown in front of him and he can't see it.
Mm.
And that, I think, is such a chilling moment. And it's one that John Pertwee plays very well.
It's also kind of unique, isn't it, for Companion's first trip in the TARDIS? Because usually it's all, oh, look at this. Oh, wow, this is amazing. And, oh, would you want to come and see another planet? Why didn't you come on an exciting adventure with me? And they go, oh, how exciting. Let's go and see the stars. And Joe's just, yeah, freaked out. And he's like, can we stop? Can we go back now? Can you let me out of here, please? And it's, yeah, it's very different.
I mean, people pick apart Joe's characterisation because of this moment. But I think it's perfectly logical, I think. You know, she's seen these strange goings-on for a year, or nearly a year, with the Doctor and the Unit and Master and everybody else, all the other aliens that have invaded Earth. But suddenly she's trapped with a madman in a box, and he ain't going back. And I think it's a defining moment in that first 2 years of Pertwee's characterisation. And for the rest of the programme, I think what I like is this big bad of this doomsday weapon set up at the start of it, and it's barely referred to until episode 4.
Yes.
I like the ordinary nature of how things build up, and I think Mac Hulk's a great writer in that he layers things layer upon layer. I mean, some of the plotting is so clearly signposted, it might as well say, next week we're back in an English church in the demons. But at the same time, I think it's done so well. I mean, Michael Bryant as well, it's his direction makes what could have been, and I know many people think it is, a really pedestrian six-parter into something that actually rollocks along at a fair old pace. And the new Blu-ray restoration definitely makes it look a lot better than it ever has. And I think that's got a large amount to do with, because I've watched it about 3 or 4 times since that box set came out.
Wow.
And I'm a man who loves Claws of Axos. That was my first Doctor Who.
I have to say, I find season 8 a very mixed bag for me. I'm not a fan of Claws of Axos. I'm not even a huge fan of Terror of the Autons, to be honest. My favourite stories are The Demons and Mind of Evil. And I don't think I've revisited Colony in Space. But this is one of the ones very much like the Sylvester McCoys and the Colin Bakers for me that I didn't really enjoy the first time round I saw them, so I never really revisited them. So, it was interesting for me to go back and watch this.
It's interesting to hear, because I know this is not a story that's particularly well-loved by... It's not going to win an award poll, this one.
No.
By any stretch of the imagination. Another huge strength of it is the cast.
Mm, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't mean Gail Platt. I'm not even going to, reference that. But watching it again, I was struck by Nicholas Pennell's portrayal of Winton. You know, he's such an action figure in it. In a secondary way, he runs that colony. And when he wrestles control of it from Ash, I know he'd been big in the Foresight saga a few years previously. And I was dismayed to read subsequently that he died quite young as well, which is a shame, because I think he would have had a tremendous career.
Yeah, and it's also, you've also got, sorry, I can't remember the actor's name. I haven't got time to, who plays Dent.
Oh, Maurice Perry.
And I was thinking to myself, where do I know him from? Where do I know him from? And do you know where I knew him from, Doc?
The Sweeney movie?
Well, the Sweeney, yeah. He's
Yeah, of course he is, yeah.
He's one of the gods, who's one of the bosses of Regan. In fact, he's even above Haskins, isn't he?
No!
Yeah, Haskins being mine and Doc's favourite character in the Sweeney.
I mean, I've seen it said of Maurice Dent's performance that he's just phoning it in.
No!
And I don't know how you can look at it and say he's phoning it in. There's such a rage and an evilness in that portrayal. Business is business. He's so greedy about what... Well, he's not greedy. It's his job to ensure the planet is mined. They don't get their bonus, you know, and it's that wonderful cynicism. And he gets it 100%. He's such a hard-nosed character.
Yeah, you only have to see that scene where they're all after the adjudicators found in their favour. And it's that rare thing in, certainly in Classic Who, where you see a group of baddies all celebrating, getting pissed because they've won.
Yes.
Yes, they're all having a drink in the control room, aren't they?
Yeah, brilliant.
I can never entirely get over the fact he looks like Mick Jagger, but I think the whole casting is critical to this. The whole strength of the IMC side and this whole idea of remorseless and exploitative capitalism. He's almost carried single-handedly by Captain Dent, isn't it? His villainy isn't actually cackling and evil and twirling his moustache, is it? But it's more, it's almost like mundane and run-of-the-mill wickedness. Yeah, it's just...
They're just doing the job.
Chaining Joe to the bomb, making the colonists take off in a defective spaceship.
Yeah, it's essentially, he's a classic psychopath, isn't he? In that these a lot of people who get to the top of corporations and stuff in real life have psychopathic traits, you know, because they have no empathy for people. They don't care who they stamp on, who they destroy to get what they want. And it's never anything personal, is it? I have recently read John Ronson's The Psychopath Test, and it mentions it mentions this, so...
Another thing I like about this is I suppose, talking about not necessarily a psychopathic tendency, but you have mass murder being attributed to both sides here. The colonists are quite prepared to do whatever it takes, up to and including execution of IMC, although it's not as heavily implied. IMC, in the meantime, are quite happy to see that rocket get blown to Kingdom Come with them all on it, because it solves the problem. And you've got perhaps the pacifist doctor stuck in the middle, although I don't suppose you can describe John Pertwee as the pacifist doctor. But no, you can, you can in this term, actually, because he wanted to find a solution to the Silurian problem the previous year. So I suppose if you were watching it in sequence...
I mean, he does still indulge himself, as William Hartnell says in The Romans, the gentle art of fisticuffs.
Yes.
I think the master's a psychopath, because... He can be evil by still being really charming, can't he? Whereas I suspect Dent is more of a sociopath in that he's just not got the empathy. So he can't even appear to be...
Charming
or cackling with glee as his enemies die. It's just the things that you factor into a balance sheet at the end of the day, isn't it? And what's his name? Caldwell is good in that he's not... He's not annoyingly virtuous. You know, and Dent's trying to say to him, look, you know, if we get this planet, you'll be rich. Think of the bonuses you'll get. And you actually do think, oh, actually, I wonder if he's going to come back onto Dent's side. You don't think, oh, he's like the doctor would say, oh, I'm not interested in filthy lucre.
Well, there's the line, isn't there, that Caldwell is bankrupt. Or he's so far in debt that he is tied to IMC. But Caldwell is the huge weak link for me in the story.
Oh, really?
He is too virtuous.
Oh, right.
Yeah. He wouldn't have lasted 5 minutes in IMC.
I thought you were going to say at Granada Studios.
5 minutes at that Coronation Street tour, and I'd have sacked him just like that. God help me when I'm older and all these memories merge into one. Dear Bernard Kay, I sacked him when I was at the Emmerdale tour.
He wouldn't last 5 minutes at Cutaway Comics.
But I suppose listening to the commentary on the DVD...
Which is a brilliant commentary, I think. One of the best I've heard for ages.
Oh, I haven't heard it.
Surprising, so a little bit. But Berner's quite critical of... Like, he takes to task Michael Bryant for the scene in part two where it's clear the tracks on the Haflinger buggy. A couple of scenes have been filmed by this point. And he's kind of brushed over and moved on. But it does show a certain conscientious approach to the role. And I do wonder... Swap out Bernard Kay for Tony Caunter, swap Morgan and Caldwell around, whether we would have had a slightly harder-nosed Caldwell. I mean, the arc of him redeeming himself by joining the colony at the end, it's all perfectly fine. Almost the problem I have is Bernard Kay's too sympathetic portrayal. How are we supposed to believe that Captain Dent wouldn't have shoved him in an airlock and he wouldn't have had a little accident and we'd have had a new mineralogist?
But that's because he's their mining engineer, isn't he? And they do say at one point, because I think Morgan suggests killing him, and he says, no, I want Caldwell back alive because he's our chief engineer.
This is explained a bit more in the book, actually, that he's the only one who can do an effective mining survey.
So does he then destroy IMC by joining the colony? Or he can't be the only mineralogist.
Yeah, but he's probably the only one on a spaceship that's light years from Earth.
Well, most of them are dead, aren't they, by that point anyway? So their
that's true.
IMC's crew members are fairly severely depleted by this point. One inconsistency I find with it a bit is the fact that he goes on board to, like you say, Bernard Kay plays him as a very sort of sympathetic person and somebody who's certainly very sympathetic with the colonists. And yet he still goes on and does sort of like a fake survey of the ship and says, no, it's all fine. You can take off in that fine.
It doesn't work, does it, really? That's the it's the niggly bit for me in it. That other than that, it feels like a lot of people are critical of Ash because he's too washy as a colonist leader. But of course he is. That's the whole point of why it's not worked. He's trying his best to what he can. You know, and that's why Dent is so successful at winning the case and the adjudicator. This man of conscience who is going to let them... You know, and he does this wince when the rocket explodes and he doesn't know it's only Ash on board. But it's too late by that point.
Yeah.
Well, by the time it blows up, they're all Ash, aren't they?
Wow.
By the way, I had no idea. The guy who plays Ash played the guy with the black stripe across his face in the Aztecs.
Oh, I was waiting for you to pronounce it.
Tloxotl, is it? Something like that.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
And I think he's brilliant here. I think he is. I can believe in him as a leader of these colonists. I can believe in him as a figure that would encourage the people onto that planet to make a new future.
Yeah.
I can buy into that. And I'd quite like to have had him there as that leadership figure. I can understand also why there is the struggle for power, because nobody's anticipating IMC turning up.
Yeah.
And you've already got it falling apart with the relationship with the primitives that is hanging by a thread. He's got to be that united figure, especially when there's all these domes that are spread out everywhere as well, that is able to push forward that colony idea. Because if you have too much of a hothead, and God knows this has been explored so much in all these westerns and other bits and pieces over the years, but it wouldn't work as a community.
No, that's true.
Mm.
And I love this bit where the Doctor and Joe walk in and suddenly they're entrusted with this and entrusted with that. And the adjudicator turns up and then is suddenly, well, actually, how do we know who you are and who we can trust? And that's all beautifully played. And the arc that the colony goes through, I mean, I was going to pick it apart again. I'm so naturally picking things apart. The arc the colony goes through makes total sense, apart from when Roy Skelton's character turns up and goes, oh, yeah, I've just come from another colony a few miles away. You know?
I think they could do better by not revealing quite so early that this is a plant. Because then you know, perhaps people were just dying in distant rooms in the complex and no one knew why. It might make it more of a surprise.
I think it's very hard to introduce him without it being quite obvious. He's a spy, to be honest. I don't see a way they could have done it without you kind of knowing quite early on anyway.
No, I agree there a little bit. And there's the other aspect we've not even got onto yet, which is the aliens in this. I mean, the design of those priests in the primitive city is fantastic. You know, when one of them walks up to Roger Delgado and Delgado's in full flow and it's squinting at him, that's just a glorious moment.
The guys are scrotums for heads.
Yeah, there is that unfortunate moment when the large-headed... it always reminds me of that scene in the web episode of Blake 7 when you see head of an actor and a tiny puppet body underneath it. It also makes me think of Reeves and Mortimer's Marvin Gaye and Otis Redding.
I'm not familiar with that.
The Bay. Doesn't matter. It's human heads, puppet bodies. But there's that moment where you can see the human head's hand behind the chair. It's a bit like the Sutex hand that holds his cushion down.
Oh, can you? Oh, no. Right.
And there's a bit you can just see. The first time that alien appears and is sliding on, you can see it looks like the actor's hand just gripping onto the back of the chair. And it's just,
Oh, no.
Spoils it a little bit. I wonder if I'd have noticed if that hadn't been on Blu-ray. I'm sure I wouldn't have noticed if I'd been watching it on
I mean, none of us could see this at all. It was on VHS and it was like watching it through a snowstorm.
Well, yeah, exactly. I wonder if that's why I've got memories of it dragging and being a lot more boring.
I think that's the six episodes that...
Yeah, but I watched all six episodes in one go yesterday, quite happily. At first, when it started, I was not looking forward to it because I had memories of watching the old VHS. And I just got carried away and just was very happy watching it. Yeah, I watched it all in one sitting, and when you said about doing Colony in Space, this is one of the three Pertwees, along with the Mutants and Monster of Peladon that I haven't watched in sort of decades.
Oh, yes, you were comparing it to having watched the Colin and Sylvester eras for ages, weren't you?
Yes, that's right. And again, I had similar feelings about them. So I seem to repeatedly go back to stuff that I hated sort of like 10, 20 years ago and keep finding myself going, do you know what? This is actually really enjoyable. I'm getting a lot out of this. Yeah, I think a lot of that is down to Malcolm Hulk's script. It's down to the cast. And I think if I had been dropping off at any point early on, sorry, that's just the memory of it. It's still, I can't. It's that robot coming in through the doors with the big claws. Oh, it's glorious.
Very War Machines and the Cleaners from Paradise Towers.
Yeah, but it's got those big claws on it, those big monster claws. It's just, my brain would not believe the messages that my eyes were sending me.
I mean, I was just going to say, I mean, I would scream if that was coming towards me, but it wouldn't be a scream, it would be a scream of horror of one sort, I would have to say. Yeah. But not necessarily the sort you're expecting.
Yeah, I'm sure Michael Bryan probably screamed with horror when he saw it.
I mean, it takes the Doctor to point out that lizard must have been 20 yes, foot high yeah. that came in here. So how did it get through that door? They're so wrapped up in it, they can't see the obvious. And that's another... But then, I don't quite know. I mean, God bless the actress who plays Jane Leeson in it, who screams when she sees
Sheila
it. God
Grant.
Bless her, because, yes, she's the voice of the Quarks, isn't she?
Oh, is she?
In The Dominators. It's a Sheila Grant that does the voice in The Dominators. Whether it's the same one or not, I don't know. I mean, maybe she had flashbacks to that. But I do love The Dominators, but maybe she had flashbacks to that and screamed. I don't know. But it shows how conniving IMC are as well through that. But the robots aren't that impressive. It sells a business organisation, but it's not as good as the little buggies they have. That
those are glorious, aren't they?
Oh, no.
The speed they go at. And not the speed, but the way they say bump. Across the landscape, they're almost like you know, like a skimming a stone across a pond because they're going so fast. They sort of hit a bump and they just go flying across the air and land again. They're brilliant.
Very, very John Pertwee.
Yeah, I bet John Pertwee was all over those.
How they got that company to lend them to them for free, I don't know.
I suppose, again, this is when Doctor Who suddenly turned a corner a bit, I suppose. And, you know, the next year in the Sea Devils, you've got the Royal Navy wanting to help out.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Or willing to cooperate. So I suppose you're in that era almost of nearly product placement in Doctor Who.
We've got a Pertwee retrospective coming up, so I've been rewatching the whole era. I couldn't believe that giant futuristic missile in Mind of Evil is actually a real ground-to-air missile that the RAF lent them.
It's crackers, isn't it, that?
It's extraordinary, isn't it?
Because a year earlier, the series is on the cusp of cancellation. Had season 7 not done it, then that would have been that. We wouldn't be sat here now.
And for years, this was the doomsday weapon to me, the book. And it was one of my favourites. And it was when I finally saw the TV version. It was quite a disappointment to me. But when I rewatched it for this retrospective that we've got coming up, I loved it. Possibly because I rewatched it on the Blu-ray. But regarding what you were saying about whether anyone would be prepared to vote for an awards thing, Mark, do you want to take your headphones off for a couple of seconds? I've got the votes in so far. We've had 82 people have voted so far, and Colonial Space has received. Come back now, Mark. Hello? Come back now.
Okay.
We'll stop revealing things.
I'm not going to reference what you just said, but it is interesting because John Pertwee was, when I was younger, was my favourite Doctor. I think it's this action figure. Might be worth me popping on for the Pertwee retrospective, actually. He's this action figure, this James Bond-esque, very commanding father figure. Actually, I completely loathe his portrayal now. Nowadays, he's arrogant, he's rude, he's a bully.
That's
and he's
interesting.
Horrendous.
I feel exactly the same.
Do you know what? I've gone the other way. I've gone in reverse. I used to think all the things that you thought in the last few years. I think that's because I've been watching them with my eldest daughter, Polly, though. She's 20 now, And we've been watching for the last, what, 5 or 6 years together, the Pertwee stories. And there's a few that we just watch over and over again because they're just, you know, it's like comfort food. And
they are like comfort, yeah.
And I was very much, I mean, I got, I think I was probably influenced, I hate to say it, by Paul Cornell's comments all those years ago and stuff, where he took it upon himself to describe the Third Doctor as a Tory
and say
what a horrible authoritarian figure he was. And I think on rewatching it, I found him to be anything but an authoritarian figure. He might be overbearing at times, but I think he's generally the one who comes in and seems to want to smash the system, it seems to me, and to look after the little people.
I'll probably be wiping a lot of this because with people saying all this during the retrospective, not during this, I might keep little bits and pieces in. That'd be this bit where we're specifically talking about his era.
Oh, yeah. But, yes. So obviously, I just found it interesting that Matt had gone in the opposite direction to me.
Yeah, because I can bring it back to Colony in Space and say that it's that first scene. I'm watching it again and again. I watched it over a few times. Mm. It really gets to me that that first trip in the TARDIS is supposed to be wondrous, and there's parallels with an unearthly child, which I think is a little bit what they're going for in some respects, because there will have been some people who have come to it, and it is it's the first trip back out into space and time. But I think, Mark, when you were saying it is a little bit like, you know, Eccleston, what planet do you want to go forwards or backwards in time, love? You know, and it's supposed to be an enjoyable trip out into space.
Hey, you do that Manchester accent really well, Matt.
Because I paid my lecky bill.
But I think this is possibly the first of his series where he becomes likeable. Because watching him from Spearhead through to Spiders, the first two series, I couldn't bear him. And I was really, really shocked at that revelation. He is so rude to people.
And he's actually tempted to take the Master's offer at the end in Colony. He's actually tempted.
I don't know if he is he? I think he's stalling for time there. That's my take on it.
He doesn't end up saying, I want to see the universe, not rule it, doesn't he?
I think that's the best use of the Master, though, in that sequence, in the whole of Season 8, in those scenes at the end. Maybe you're right, actually, because actually you've got Pertwee becoming a little bit more self-assured, and you've got Delgado, well, the characters, obviously, that sort of spiralling apart.
Yes.
Because he's almost got his hands on what he wants for a change. You compare that to next week, where he's in a crypt in an English village.
Yeah.
Or the previous week, where he's prisoner on an alien spaceship. Here, he's actually just about got what he wants, and he's falling apart. So maybe you are right. But the ongoing thread, which is done so well, considering arcs weren't really a thing, of this desperation to be off Earth, and he is finally off Earth, the Doctor. I can't help but wonder whether the Master's offer throws him for a second. Because the Time Lords aren't going to give him what he wants.
No. Well, he's already twigged. I mean, that's one of the things I was going to say, which ties in. But the other thing that sort of perhaps is frightening for Joe when the TARDIS is off is the Doctor's going, I'm not doing this. I'm not even in control. It's the Time Lords are doing it. So he's like, yeah, we're off into time and space and I've got absolutely no control over it whatsoever, which is probably hugely alarming. You know, so like if somebody said, hey, do you want to have a trip in my new Ferrari? And you get in and they start driving. They go, and they suddenly turn
the brakes
and they've got
the work.
Steering wheel in their hand going, and it'd be like, oh. Although perhaps he's mulling over the fact that maybe if he helps the Time Lords out, that he'll be able to get his TARDIS back.
That's an interpretation I hadn't considered, actually.
Because he spends a lot of time there rubbing his lip, doesn't he? As opposed to the back of his neck for once. Which he does a lot in this story, doesn't he? The back of his neck gets a lot of attention in this story.
Of course, it's really a surprise in that the weapons control room that it's still an issue, isn't it? Because you've got this city that's full of this priestly class who are half blind and they're waving their arms around everywhere. And the self-destruct switch is that whacking great lever sticking out of the console. So all you have to do is knock it. And it immediately starts blowing up the city. You'd have thought that one of those priests would have knocked it by now, wouldn't you?
The primitives don't work for me, I have to admit. I think the primitives work in so much as they're there to be ciphers for the characters and be that threat with the spheres. I think the mistake is casting them as the stuntmen, who are not necessarily monster actors here. I think that's one area where, obviously they're there to do a lot of the stunt work. You know, John Pertwee jumps out of one of these Haflinger things and starts pummeling the Watsies out of two of them just because they're in the way, you know?
Hi!
Quite. I mean, I think as well, watching some of the action in that quarry, it's not that dissimilar in colour tone to the Caves of Androzani and the outdoor bits there. And if you transpose those buggies into... I mean, Graham Harper's the AFM on this as well.
Mm. Yeah, it's true.
There's a bit of a synergy there. I mean, it doesn't help that they're grey, you know, and I suppose that doesn't help with the colour tone and the conversion of what we've seen. I mean, I dread to go back and watch the VHS of this now. I think it will be borderline unwatchable. What were they thinking, putting Colony in Space and a Time Monster out in a box set with a picture like that? What were they thinking?
I can't help but wonder, having watched a bit of the making of, I mean, a lot of the complaints about this story are to do with the setting, because it is so kind of dreary, and it's a quarry, and it's a very muddy, unpleasant looking quarry at that. And you think about how it would have looked if Planet of Fire, they'd managed to record it abroad as Michael Bryant wanted to in Tenerife. And you think about how good it would be if they'd been able to afford to make it feel like the colony was bigger than just that one room.
How,
you know, and they do things like they staged the fight, that gunfight, right in front of one of those painted backdrops. Which, when you're focusing at people down on the floor, away from them, it's fine, because you just see sort of the sort of vague outline of what looks like big hangars and stuff in the background. But when it's in the gunfight, and perhaps it's a victim of the Blu-ray as well, it's so clearly obvious that it's the painted backdrop. And I just think, if they could have had the budget, I just think the story could have been...
It could have been top of the pile, couldn't it?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's interesting, because that backdrop, which doesn't seem to fit with the colony setting, it looked even sharper than a 70s TV, I guess. But after Colony in Space, each week the BBC showed a Western that was broadly, you can read into it, they were broadly aligned with the themes that were going on in that episode. So where you've got a traitor and where you've got an ambush and other bits and pieces like that. And you've got I suppose people were far more forgiving. But you have got this clearly under budget or doing the best they can show, and then a full-colour featured cowboy film on afterwards. It's an interesting comparison. Mm. But then the other side of it is, I mean, the design work on that geodesic dome that they keep going in and out of.
Yes.
That now looks space age, let alone what it must have looked like then.
Yeah, that surprised me, actually. I was surprised how great that looked. It's really impressive. I didn't look at the special edition version. Is there new effects on it and stuff?
No, it's just a better, sharper transfer.
Oh, right. Okay.
That thing, wasn't it, when they're having the gunfight in the colonist dome, where as those machine guns are going off, there are lines going across the screen, because as they're hitting the microphone, it's affecting something.
As Doctor Who fans will well know.
So they've sorted that out, yeah.
No, it's much more pronounced, and I would argue a little bit worse, unfortunately, on the Blu-ray.
Oh, really?
Picture really does. I mean, they've done the best they can with it. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I was so surprised how much vibrancy was in the picture, because you've got the DVD edition is on one of the discs in the Blu-ray, but then the documentaries must use the VHS copy, because presumably they were still working on the restoration as they were doing it. And I might as well get a tub of Vaseline and smear it across my screen.
Oh, what are you going to say then?
Yes.
And smear it across something else, because I was so excited about it. But Mike, I've got the Demons to watch still yet, but I've kind of sped through the omnibus version just to have a quick nosy at it. And I notice episode 4 seems to be the original tape or the original master of it, from what I can tell. No pun intended there. My God, that's so sharp. And it's such a shame this is one of the seasons that loses. I mean, Terror of the Autons didn't look particularly... It still doesn't look particularly smooth or great. The new CGI looks brilliant, but it sticks out a mile. And it's a shame, because that affects the reputation of a lot of these stories. I was struck by how pacey Terror of the Autons was. Colony in Space feels glacial by comparison.
Yeah, I have to say, despite my sort of criticism of that backdrop and stuff, those sort of things and the original CSO special effects that have never bothered me in the slightest. No. It's never detracted from me. I'd rather watch those personally than a special edition with CGI graphics on it, because I think CGI graphics can also date quite badly as well and look even more out of place in sort of like 5-10 years than the original CSO does in a way. And I do like to see things as close to broadcast sort of level as possible, just because I just, you know.
I'm going to be a bit grumbly here about the Planet of the Daleks CGI. Planet of the Daleks is definitely my comfort Pertwee. I suppose that stems from the 93 repeat. And I was so excited. I didn't get to the BFI one for it. So I didn't see it until I got the box set in my grubby little hands.
Oh, that was funny.
And whoop, out comes the disc. And the CGI on that is... I mean, technically it's good, but it's just not right. The Dalek army scenes at the end, they don't look realistic. No. And neither does the Dalek spaceship landing. It's the sort of thing that I'm going to pop in the player in 10 years' time and go...
Yes. The Dalek army looks like little things that will come in a board game, doesn't it? And the wobbly spaceship coming down looks like, you know, those little metal lids they used to put on the top of plates of hot food in a canteen at school.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, I don't want to knock them because they've obviously, again, they're working to a budget on these sets, but I'd have spent the money cleaning up the Green Death.
I tell you what was the first. When the Doctor and Joe and the Master encounter each other, they're all equally as surprised as each other, aren't they? The Master almost does a double take.
Oh, this is one scene I do want to talk about because I love the little cough Delgado gives. You know, we're all expecting it, but they're not. Neither the Master nor the Doctor and Joe are expecting to see each other on that planet. And it's just a lovely little moment where suddenly in this backwater colony on a backwater planet, the two Time Lords are facing each other with him dressed up as an adjudicator. I mean, it's such a typical Master thing to do. And I think the way it's played, you also... I don't think you necessarily get that, oh, no, it's the Master, which you perhaps would have done in part one of Axos and when he turns up in the Demons. You've had a few weeks without him here in a Master-centric season.
And then he's got that line...
No, I think that's probably fair.
I'm afraid you're both about to become the victims of stray bullets. It's always the innocent bystander who suffers eventually, isn't it? Lines I thought Mark would love Ash for. If we go back to Earth, we'll be worse off than we were before. All our savings have gone into this. Now that's the equivalent of Mark's favourite line from Dinosaurs.
I sold my house. Delivered by one of the actors in Colony in Space, isn't it? Because it's Tony Cornter.
Was that Tony Cornter?
I believe. Is it not Tony Cornter who says I sold my house in Invasion of the Dinosaurs?
God, this is sad, isn't
it?
I'm just going into Google and typed in Invasion. It's automatically brought up Invasion of the Dinosaurs. So it's obviously got whatever, what do they call them? And these algorithms has clearly worked me out, haven't they? Let's see, Tony Cornter.
Invasion of Dinosaurs is very much my comfort Pertwee.
Terribly. Terribly underrated Invasion of the Dinosaurs.
Yeah. Purely, I think, because of the special effects.
I think the special effects, for the most part, are quite... Again, I must be watching a different Doctor Who, as opposed to most people. I think they're quite ambitious in some ways. I've not watched it in a while, to be fair, because I'm kind of waiting for the Blu-ray to rumble around now.
Mm.
But I remember the scene of Yates being at the T-Rex's foot.
Mm.
And it looking quite well composited. It's not going to win any awards, but it sells it for me. And when the pterodactyl's chasing John Pertwee around that garage area, that's fantastic as well.
Yeah. Obviously, this is probably chat we can't have until retrospective.
Spoken by an actor called Timothy Craven.
Craven. Oh, right, okay. Oh, I did. Why did I think
I
it was...
I think you've always thought that. I don't think we've just known enough to contradict you.
Yeah, maybe.
Talking about Blu-rays, Matt, we were talking about that on our last podcast. You know this announcement that having sold us these special collection box sets, which are big chunky cardboard ones, because I've been all my life, but for years, I've been thinking, I would have so much more room if they just brought out whole seasons in a DVD box set, perhaps the size of the... Do you remember the Lost in Time box set they did for the Orphaned episodes? Yeah. Just about, maybe just about twice the size of a normal one. Instead of which, they bring them out in these huge boxes. I might as well have a row of six DVDs on the shelf as those. What are your thoughts on that? Because I don't know whether they're going to release the blocky one with all the artwork on first and then release the sort of vanilla, ordinary one a year down the line. Or whether they'll do it at the same time. Because if they do it at the same time, I'd go for the vanilla one any time.
Now, you see, the thing here with this is, I suppose we all should have seen this coming because there will be people who buy both. Yeah. And there will be people who... I mean, I'm just looking at my shelf now and I'm looking at the eight of them stacked up and I'm thinking if they are next to it, I've got the James Bond box set, which is in two slightly large Blu-ray cases, which I presume is the size they'll use for these seasons, and one smaller one. And I'm just thinking, you know, my shelves are fit to burst as it stands. I mean, I'm having apoplexy. I'm quite OCD about the condition things arrive in. And one of these box sets I ordered, I think it was... the last Tom Baker season arrived and the disc tray was shattered, and by the time someone came back to me at a replacement, it sold out everywhere. And it's just like, well, what do I do now? You know, and it's first world problems and all that, because there are people, you know, but at the same time, by nature, we are a fandom that like things to be nice and pristine in most cases. And there's horror tales of the glue coming off the back of them. And I'm thinking it would be just so much easier if I just had them in a plastic case, because I don't even touch the damn things in case they fall apart. But at the same time...
At least it's a punch on the nose for these scalpers who buy...
For investing in the range in the first
place.
Who buy
huge numbers of these and then sell them on eBay for £100.
Well, I'm not being a scalper here. What I did was I ordered two of the Pertwee, the Season 8 box set, because I nearly didn't get Season 14, because that was the first one out during the pandemic. And I'm willing to suspect that if you walked into your local branch of, and let's face it, it's the only place left now to get them, HMV on the street, they're not going to have Season 8.
No.
It's an old release.
No, they don't. I was in there today.
And they don't.
No.
It's interesting that, because I kind of thought, do I hedge my bets and wait till it comes? Or, because the last one, my local postie just dropped it by the door because of the COVID thing. And I just winced inside because that was discs flying everywhere and whatnot. So I ordered two with my thinking that a friend said, actually, I didn't get one in time. If you both arrive, so I was going to hit the button and cancel one as soon as one was dispatched. But they both dispatched exactly the same time from two separate places. Of course they did. And someone said, oh, yeah, I'll take the other one off your hands because I couldn't order it. But then a spate of them suddenly arrived before they came out. So they said, oh, yeah, no, I've got it. So I've now got a second one that I can't shift for the price I paid for it. I can only seem to get about £30 for it.
Well, Hayden had that problem. Because we pre-order on things like Amazon or Zoom. And Hayden pre-ordered Season 8 on Amazon, didn't he? And he ended up having to cancel it.
Was it on Amazon?
Or whatever. He ended up having to cancel it and going back. He ended up getting it at Argos quite easily. I thought it was quite surprised me.
Yeah. Now, that is going to be the key to this, I think. Because what we're seeing here, I think, is that people are going to be willing to wait because they've already got them on DVD.
Yeah.
So they're quite happy to wait and get it far easier. I think Zoom collapsing or being taken over or whatever's gone on there, I think is a great crying shame because obviously these were huge sellers for them. And I understand that Doctor Who fans are not going to prop up a company, you know, but that is a... That's a huge...
Well, we've probably got the BBC for long enough.
That's a huge problem for these going forward because there's always that anxiety, and I use that word very lightly here, but we like to see a complete collection of 1 to 26.
Yes. God, how long would our shelf have to be for that?
Well, I've got... It's Billy bookshelves I've got, and the eight of them take up half a shelf, so it's going to be 1.5 shelves. That's assuming the 60s sets aren't even wider. I'm kind of going off on a tangent here, but in response to your original question, I'm a bit annoyed. I bought the bloody new series ones in the steel box because I'm a sucker for a steel book, and I missed series six because of the pandemic, and I'm not going to pay £80 for it now. Second, you know, on the second hand market.
Well, these Blu-rays come along, and then I discover that my PC can't read Blu-rays, so I can't rip things off them, so I can't throw away all my DVDs. So what I've done now is I've taken all my DVDs, this will horrify you, I've thrown away all the boxes, and I've just bought one of these big sort of wallets that holder back, 80 discs in them. And I've just bunged them all in there. Because I've just simply not got the room for them these days.
I think you have to. If you'd have asked me that question a year ago, I'd have gone, yeah. But now I'm just sat here thinking, there's so much stuff that I've acquired. I used to be quite, I don't think I'll go back to, but I used to, with the sort of semi-collapse of the DVD market a bit, you know, you can get a lot of recent releases in charity shops, you know, so cheaply.
My sister managed to buy Wonder Woman 84 in a charity shop today on DVD for £1.
The thing is, Mark and I sync watch things, given that we're both single guys. Before we go to bed at night, we'll say, oh, should we watch something? We'll put a DVD on, and then we'll, on Facebook Messenger, we'll say, press now. As we're watching it, we'll chat to each other about it by text message. We've been going through the collected box set of The Sweeney, which has got four seasons in, four full seasons, and the box is no bigger than a single one of those collection boxes of the Blu-rays. If they can do that...
No. And, yeah, it's bad.
The whole point of Blu-rays, wasn't it? It was supposed to be that they could contain vastly more information than a DVD.
Yeah, I got the complete Babylon 5 in the old style where they had them in individual cases. So that's the 5 series, Crusade, all of them for a fiver from the charity shop. But it's half a flaming shelf. I mean, I've still got all the VHSs somewhere as well.
I finally watched that for the first time last year, and I really liked it. No, I loved all the various alien races that they had on that. I mean, that guy who wanders around with them. You know those horse collars that people used to gurn through? The guy's head consists of that.
But I am not buying Doctor Who again now. I will buy the new series if they come out in the collection.
Yeah.
I don't care whether it's in 4K, spangly HD, because there's somebody that's they've up-converted the Blu-ray into even sharper quality. I think it's a clip of Mind of Evil I've seen, actually. And it's a clip of the Three Doctors. It's where the Doctor and Joe hide behind Bessie when the antimatter thing comes out. And it's so sharp, you'd be able to cut your tongue on it. But I'm not buying them again now. You know, by the time I've bought all 26 of these, that's going to be...
Well, even the Babylon 5, I just streamed on Netflix or whatever, or Amazon Prime, whatever it was. I very rarely buy stuff now.
That's if they get all 26 out. That's the other danger here as well. What would we do if they didn't? I mean, I suspect there'd be comparative. If you, there'd be a lot of Doctor Who fans at either end of the spectrum. If they started with one and went sequentially through to 26, there'd be some people who would be saying, oh, well, forget the last six seasons. I can't be bothered with them. And they've got to do it in this haphazard nature. But if the range does collapse for whatever reason, it's not a question of what we're going to do, because we've still got the DVDs. Yeah. But the love and care and attention that's got into them, I think it would be a great shame. And I saw a lot of response to the fact that we're bringing them out again because of people who paid £300 for Tom Baker season 12.
Well, that's the nature of business and life, though, isn't it? If you, you know, you take a chance... I'm glad that these are coming out because it stops, you know, I feel sorry for people who have paid
£300.
I mean, presumably they can afford it, otherwise they wouldn't be doing it. You know, you'd like to think they haven't had to sell an organ or something to do it.
Mark was season 12, didn't you? And Hayden and I just said, just give it a while and they'll re-release more copies eventually. But of course, if you're in fandom, and not just in fandom, but doing what we do and actually... podcasting about it, you can't really afford to say, I'll wait until a couple of years until the other one comes out.
And also, life's too short. It is 2 years since the first one came out, so we're potentially looking at a 2-year delay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are saying that all the projections of what might come out take us to 2026.
Yeah.
That's a long way into the future for me to queue up and get my animated Highlanders on season 4.
What if they continue producing the DVDs? But it takes so long that by that time, society's advanced so far that they don't sell shelves anymore.
Well, that would be a bit of a conundrum. That would be a total conundrum. I might stock up on some shelves before that happens. So I've got spare ones in the event that there is a problem with that.
Yeah, but they'll take up all your shelf space, all those flat-pack shelves.
Yeah. I'm more concerned about the fact that they don't make Blu-ray players by the time the last Blu-ray comes out. That feels like a very Doctor Who thing, actually. That by the time the last one comes out, we'll have nothing to watch it on, and we can all sit around and moan about it.
But if you think about it, we've all bought, haven't we, the VHS, we bought the DVD, we bought the... Do you remember when they were... What were they bringing out? Mini... weren't they going to replace either DVDs or Blu-rays with mini discs that are only the size of a beer mat or something? Anyway.
But some people have bought them on Laserdisc as well.
Yes, I was going to say, Laserdisc. Don't forget plucky old Laserdisc.
I mean, Spearhead from Space, I've bought 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times so far. I don't even like it.
I was going to say, no wonder he likes it. Anyway, back to Colony in Space.
But I do like Colony in Space, and I will buy that if that comes out in Ultra HD.
I didn't realise this, I only noticed this while I was preparing for today, that when the Radio Times came out for the first week of this, which was 10th till the 16th of April 1971, they had in it a little, you know, bit of blurb saying, and there's the Doctor's new story. He travels in space for the first time in ages. And they got Frank Bellamy to draw a couple of full-colour pages sketching the opening scenes of Colony in Space, and a couple of half-page black and whites, which is quite nice, which can be found if you want them at frankbellamy.co.uk under these Doctor Who section. Links in the show notes, as ever at all.
Have you not got your complete history volume there at all, Doc? There's a nice full-page spread of them in there as well, which I'm just looking
complete
at.
Complete history of what?
The Andrew Pixley part work that came out.
Oh, right, no, I never got that. I have a go at that.
Mine are still in storage, as I moved several times since I started collecting them. And so bits of them, the complete collection's ended up, bits of it just going into storage part at a time.
Colony in Space is also the story at which, during rehearsals for the first studio session, Barry Letts conned John Pertwee and Katie Manning into coming out into the Television Centre parking lot to record a trailer. And that's where they got ambushed by Eamon Andrews for Pertwee's This Is Your Life.
Oh.
That bizarre thing where Morgan was originally cast as a woman.
Oh, but that would have been great. What, if Morgan had been cast as a woman?
I don't mean bizarre casting as a woman, and bizarre how they reacted to it, how the head of Serials said.
Oh, yeah.
We can't have him as a sadistic female because it would leave the BBC open to charges of fetishism.
Yeah, I think the quote was something about it would just be far too kinky.
A great shame.
For a family show.
A great shame.
Links for all these things, of course, in our show notes at our podcast blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Have we got anything? Oh, God, we reached 7. We've been doing this for 2.5 hours.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I've probably got about another 10 minutes in me before I start getting my nads.
Yes,
off.
Me too. So, your what's chopped off?
Me nads. I nearly said the B word then, but...
Who by?
Me girlfriend.
Oh, right. Are you in Manchester or London?
Yeah, Manchester. She moved up here.
Oh, right. Wow. You know what that means, don't you? She sees you as a keeper. Is it a keeper? Mm. What do they call it?
Yeah.
But it's been a long few years.
Do you share now? Are you in the same place now?
Yeah, we're motoring along. We've not killed each other during the lockdown, so... Yet.
Oh, well, excellent.
Yeah, there's still time. There's still time. I don't go back to work until Thursday. There's still time.
Right.
Should we do our rounding off then?
Unless anyone's got anything more they want to say about Colony in Space, Hayden, not willing to be left out, has left us an audio cassette of his views on Colony in Space. So let's play that now.
Hello guys, it's Hayden here. I'm a little bit sad to have missed out, I must say, on this episode of Diddly Dum, because I haven't spoken to Matt in years, and of course he was my old co-presenter, and you could say I started on my Diddly Dum journey with him, so it's a shame I missed him this time round, but I hope that you are well, Matt, and I hope that yourself, Doc and Mark are keeping well also. So, though, Colony in Space. Never really been one that I've ever really gone back to much of the Pertwee era. It's one of those that sort of falls into the camp for me with... all those other six-parters that always seem a little bit overdrawn. Like they're just reaching for the episode count, really. But I think, actually, I've turned a bit of a corner with this story, watching it on the recent Blu-ray release. And it was just a very simple thing that I've done. I mean, to be honest, I've always thought that the cast is brilliant. Of course, you know, you've got Roger Delgado there in a story that I think by this point is absolutely cemented that chemistry and that relationship that he has with Pertwee. And I know they were at one point thinking that they were going to announce the Doctor and the Master as brothers in the show, but you could kind of see where they're going with that here, with the squabbling and the one-upmanship. And of course, this is his fourth story in a row by now, but I think because he only arrives halfway through it, it doesn't feel like a tired trope to me. But anyway, back to that cast. It's a fantastic cast. I mean, John Ringham as Ash. Helen Wirth, of course. Gail Platt in Coronation Street in an early TV appearance here. Tony Quarter in a very gruff tone, I'd say, as Morgan, actually. Roy Skelton here as Norton. It's interesting when you see Roy Skelton actually on screen instead of doing the voices of things like the Daleks and the computer in the Ice Warriors and the Sidemen, of course, Zippy and George. But yeah, looking very young here as Norton, the turncoat, and you're running this. And of course, Bernard Kay, who's one of my favourite Doctor Who supporting cast members, I must say. I really like Caldwell's confliction in this. And I think it works better for me this time out because I'll get to it in a moment. And I even enjoyed Maurice Perry as Captain Dent, who seems to be this kind of blend of Tim Brooke Taylor and Christopher Robin and a pencil all put in a microwave oven and making this person with the most ghastly of haircuts. But he's very stoic and very no-nonsense bureaucratic Captain Dent. It always helps when you've got a script written by as good a writer as Malcolm Hulk, who really had a great understanding of characterisation. And I think having a 6-episode arc this time round allows those characters to develop and to breathe. And that's the reason why it worked for me this time, is because I allowed the story to breathe instead of trying to race through it like I've done in the past. You know, when the DVD came out, nearly 10 years ago, I think, I watched all 6 episodes back to back. And just some stories you can do that with that length of it, but others you just can't. Others you do just have to break it down. I think I said on a recent podcast about how Fury from the Deep, the recent animation, I really enjoyed that, but that's because I was doing it in 2-episode blocks. Well, I've watched Colony in Space in 1- and 2-episode blocks, and I have to say it has greatly improved in its standing in the Pertwee era for me. I mean, it's not as boring as Frontier in Space. Story, I don't know, it's got lots to going for it, but just every time I have to mention it, Frontier in Space. Ugh. No, it's nothing like that one. It's got a lot going for it. I like the plot. The Guardian reminds me of that. Doc and Mark are going to be screaming at me now listening to this, but from that Alien from the Web episode of Blake 7. It's a bit silly and it's a bit crude, even by the standards of 1970-71. But the character itself I quite like, I have to say. You know, MC Robot, again, a little bit silly. I don't see any difference between that and the robot in Paradise Towers, really. But it's great. I mean, it's directed superbly as well by Michael E. Bryant, especially the action sequences, which I always remember the little glimmers of the action that they had from the 16mm film snippets that were in More Than 30 Years in the TARDIS, which, as you well know, long-running listeners, I've always greatly admired. So I think, yeah, it's a great story. It's not a great story. It's a good story. It's upgraded from a bad to a good for me. I haven't got the nostalgia that other fans do from the Target novelisation, because, of course, that would be one of the first ones that was released back in 1974. So I don't have a special affiliation with it. I like the idea of the Doomsday Weapon. I like the idea of what it can do. A bit like Claws of Axos for me. It's a script where, if they were to go down the route of the actual implications of what this threat can do, especially at the hands of the Master, it could be a much better story. It could really elevate it. I've always thought that about Axos, and now I think that's about Colony in Space too. So yes, it's really good story. It's fun. It's not as thought-provoking as I thought it would be, even though you've obviously got the corporation going against the people here. I think I enjoyed it more than I have done in the past because of my not wanting to sort of gobble it up all in one big omnibus. And I think with every passing watch as well, the little touches seem to become more resonant, like the scene with obviously Joe Grant and the Doctor at the start when she really doesn't want to go on the adventure. I find that quite profound, really. I can't really remember many other companions doing that. And I love the little bookend they have of Nick Courtney, the Brig, being there at the start and then at the very end. It's very much like a book in that sense. You've got the chapter start and the chapter end. And I'd be surprised if people watching this 6 weeks later would have remembered that first scene in episode one. It's a strong one for you. I'm going to give it 6.5 out of 10. It's a good story. It's not quite up there still for my favourite Pertwee stories, but a great improvement and miles better than its cousin.
I can't do it.
Oh, no, I'm going to have to go to bed. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to hang up, guys. Oh, just that story. Anyway, I will see you again soon, in which hopefully I'll be back in the Whoseum. Until then, take care, all of you.
Marks out of 10?
Give me a number out of 10. 10 being woohoo, 1 being...
I would give it... an 8.
Go on, Mark.
Okay, I would give it... It's funny, because when I was watching it, I was thinking towards the 7, 7.5. But as we've been discussing it, I've been thinking, and I found myself nodding along to all the nice things people have been saying. I think I might have to bump it up to an 8 as well. I love the fact, one other bit I wanted to say, sorry, was just the fact I like that it kind of starts off like a Scooby-Doo episode where somebody's trying to scare off the colonists who've arrived so they can take all the treasure for themselves.
Yoinks.
Yeah, jinkies.
Matt, marks out of 10?
9.
Oh, well done.
9. High praise indeed. Much better than City of Death. 9 out of 10.
Well, thanks for coming along, Matt. I've really enjoyed it, actually. It's like you've never been away. And we'll give you plenty of notice of when we're planning to do our Pertwee retrospective if you fancy coming
I'd
along to it.
I'd love to join that. Yeah, I'd love to join that and put the boot into the old bugger.
Oh, look who's coming down the corridor. He's clearly escaped from behind the time dams for a bit of a wander. It's Uncle Brucey.
Hello, I'm in charge here. I can't stand the confusion in my mind. In my mind, the confusion I can't stand.
Uncle Brucey.
I want to go home.
Uncle Brucey, I think Matt has now so exhausted that we might have to find somewhere to dump his body. Have you got any recommendations?
You don't dump it into the river. Into the river, don't dump Matt's body.
Uncle Brucey, we have tour guide managers in Sector 27.
It's a trap.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum is liquid podcasting. Stick it in your ear, old sunshine.